Hello, it's The Week in Art. I'm Ben Luke. This week, the Whitney Biennial reviewed, visitor figures at museums, and a Peter Bruegel the Elder drawing. The latest biennial at the Whitney Museum of American Art opened this week, and I discussed the show with Ben Sutton, the art newspaper's editor in the Americas, and the critic Annabelle Keenan. Our annual survey of visitor numbers at museums is published in the next print edition of the art newspaper, and Lee Cheshire, the co-editor of our report, joins me to discuss the findings. And this episode's work of the week is Peter Bruegel the Elder's drawing The Temptation of St. Anthony from around 1556. It features in the exhibition Bruegel to Rubens' Great Flemish Drawings, which opens this week at the Ashmolean Museum in Oxford in the UK. Anne Van Camp, the curator of the show, joins me to discuss this remarkable study. Our subscription offer for the art newspaper is still available, 50% off our annual digital subscription packages. Visit theartnewspaper.com to find out more. Do also subscribe to this podcast and our sister podcast, A Brush With, wherever you're listening. A Brush With returns next week. Please also give us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts. Now, the 81st edition of the Whitney Biennial is now open. The event has, since 1932, surveyed contemporary art in the United States. For those of you who are doing maths, it began as an annual exhibition. The latest edition features 71 artists and collectives, many of whom feature in film and performance programmes selected by guest curators alongside the main organisers of the show, who are Chrissy Isles and Meg Onley, both curators at the Whitney. To quote the museum, the selected artists collectively probe the cracks and fissures of the unfolding moment, and the show's title is even better than the real thing. Our editor in the Americas, Ben Sutton, and the critic Annabelle Keenan have been to the Whitney to see the biennial, and I asked them what they made of it. Ben, the exhibition's called Even Better Than the Real Thing. What do you think's meant by that title?
I went into the exhibition expecting, based on that title, for there to be a lot more engagement with artificial intelligence and disinformation and all the sort of hallmarks of the last 15 or so years of reality kind of slipping away. And there are a couple of pieces in the show that fit that bill, but honestly, it felt far more nuanced and unclear exactly what the sort of focus on the real meant or how it was manifesting in the show. There's one piece that is very overtly about and uses artificial intelligence, but aside from that, at least as far as I could tell, it felt like a very kind of impressionistic title.
Yeah, that's curious, isn't it, Annabelle? Because actually, you know, in the blurb around the show, one of the first things that is mentioned is about AI complicating our understanding of what is real. So I was expecting, like Ben, that there was going to be a hell of a lot more stuff about AI and its effect on our culture. And we know that there's lots of art being made about that right now, but it's surprising that not much of it makes the cut into the show.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I was expecting there to be a lot more artificial intelligence. I was pleasantly surprised that that wasn't really what was being taken on directly. Obviously, the title made me think that is what we were about to dive into. The only piece, like Ben mentioned, that I recalled was just one work. And then there was also a way that you could access through their digital portal to kind of engage with it more. But, you know, the title, I think for me, what it really brought up was this concept of authenticity and reframing what exactly that real lived experience is for, you know, lots of different people, different groups. And I felt that that did come across a pretty strong way for me, you know, rethinking what exactly the lived experience is for different people. So that's kind of how I approached it and was glad to see that it was a broader understanding of the word real.
I guess, Ben, that's present in the sort of materiality of lots of the works in the show. It seems like a show that is surprisingly, given what our preconceptions might have been, textural and wanting the visitor to get a sense of touch, if you like, in the work.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's honestly, going into the exhibition, I was surprised by that, because if you look at the kind of checklist and the list of artists, it's a lot of video, it's a lot of installation, it's a lot of work that you wouldn't necessarily expect to have that kind of richness of texture. But yeah, there is so much work that is really just sort of begging you to reach out and touch, whether that's, you know, Suzanne Jackson has this absolutely gorgeous room of hanging paintings. I mean, calling them paintings is sort of oversimplifying it, but her work is just these kind of gorgeous, translucent, hanging, multi-material objects that, for lack of a better vocabulary, we have to call paintings. There's a beautiful set of hanging sculptures by Hector Garcia that are just kind of similarly, you just want to sort of get in there and like pull apart. There's a lot of work that really does invite the senses in a really nice way. And I guess, yeah, to Annabelle's point, maybe the point of engaging with the real is more about the kind of reality of lived experience and of material than this question of AI that we've all been so focused on for the last couple of years.
Absolutely. And Annabelle, another thing that sort of very much flagged up in advance was the biennial, totally in keeping with its history, as a, and I'll quote from the blurb around the show, a space where difficult ideas can be engaged and considered. Do you feel that in the show? Is that something that is front and center?
To be honest, that was one of the points that I had really reflected on, because with the Whitney Biennial in particular in the last few editions, I think that we were all expecting a lot of controversy. Right now in this global climate, I think that we were perhaps expecting it even more. I didn't really feel that the issues that I expected to be taken on were taken on in a very loud way. I thought there was a lot of quiet activism in a sense. I think that one word that a lot of critics and during the members preview as well, there was a word that I kept hearing, which was it was kind of polite and safe because there wasn't anything too controversial. That's not to say that the messages were not impactful, but I just felt that there could have been a few stances that were taken on in a stronger way, which I'm happy to go into as well.
Right, absolutely. We can go into that in a bit. And Ben, I'm picking up on that point about the reviews that Annabelle just mentioned. The New York Times did a review where they asked three different critics to take on, and each of them in their own way used terms very much like the polite one that Annabelle just said. You know, so Jason Farrago says it was low risk and polite. Travis Deal said that it was riskless. And Martha Schwendener said that it was well-researched, well-intentioned, beautifully installed, if sedate. These are not words you associate with the Whitney Biennial, are they?
No, but you know, that was my initial reaction as well, that I sort of wanted more of like a brash statement, you know, especially after, like, I think the 2022 edition in particular is a good example of sort of curators playing to what we expect from the Whitney Biennial. You know, that was the first edition after the pandemic. It was in this moment of sort of total upheaval coming out of the Trump presidency in January 6th and the Black Lives Matter movement and sort of all the things that we went through from 2020 onward. And, you know, the curators organized it into these two levels, one of which was completely somber and dark and very sort of steeped in trauma and grieving, and the other that was full of light and kind of possibility. And it felt, you know, for the moment, like a very kind of brash curatorial statement. And this, like I was saying, my initial reaction was kind of like, oh, I wanted that, or I was expecting, or perhaps subliminally craving that kind of broad curatorial statement in this one. And I'm sort of slowly coming around to the sense that maybe actually the lack of that kind of grandstanding is a strength of the show, that there are these kind of like discrete couplings and certain rooms where, you know, two bodies of work really speak to each other nicely, or areas where, you know, three or four pieces that are kind of in the same conversation around, like, I don't know, archaeology or aging, or, you know, there are these kind of interesting subsets of work that speak to each other really nicely. And I think they've done a very nice job, the curators, Chrissy Isles and Meg Onley, of sort of allowing the work to breathe in a way, which hasn't always been the case in Whitney Biennials. You know, for better and for worse, often there's just this sort of crunch of work everywhere, and it's sort of like pieces are sort of fighting to get their point across. And they've done a very nice job, I think, of like not overdoing it.
I was wondering, Annabelle, actually, if one of the reasons the show is as it is because in a way it would be the most obvious thing in contemporary America to make an extremely combustible show, and to make a show which is all about firecrackers and extreme kind of language and so on. And that to make a subtle show seems counterintuitive, and therefore maybe it is a very Whitney Biennial thing to do.
Yeah, I agree with that. One thing that I really reflected on was the fact that, you know, we are so accustomed to these loud displays of activism in daily life, not inside the museum, on social media, in everywhere we interact, going down the street. If you're in a big city like New York, there's activism everywhere. And for me, I didn't feel that the show wasn't doing enough. I felt that it actually was doing enough, because I think that even, you know, the activism in the show, it is there. Sometimes, you know, you have to look for it. But I think that for me, it kind of validated that perhaps activism and standing up for issues is becoming the norm. And that is something that's worth reflecting on as well.
Let's talk about the work which has attracted the most attention over the past few days, Ben, because it was a work which was a sort of guerrilla bit of activism, if you like, by Demian Dineyazi. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, so this is a large neon piece by the Diné artist Demian Dineyazi, and it faces one of the giant walls of windows in the Whitney, so it actually looks out onto the West Side Highway and the Hudson River, and it's this large three-stanza text neon piece. The text is a piece that the artist composed. It's about apocalypse and this sense, I guess, very much speaking to the current moment of the impossibility or the difficulty that we have in imagining a kind of happier future, and the fact that we sort of tend to go for the apocalyptic and the doomsday-ish in our forward thinking. And so the piece is basically about sort of imagining utopia or liberation or, you know, freedom from things like genocide and violence and environmental collapse. And so during the preview, several people noted, and it's very, very subtle, but across this three stanza piece, there are these individual letters that sort of start to flicker and cut out, and the rest of the piece stays illuminated in this kind of like very hot red color. But then these few letters go out, and if you piece them together, it says Free Palestine. And it was revealed in reporting by the New York Times and ArtNet that the curators didn't know that this was actually in the piece until it was pointed out to them. So yeah, a kind of really subtle, very, very subtle bit of guerrilla activism.
And I think, to the Whitney's credit, they have said, we didn't know about this, but this is to be expected. We're asking artists to come and make these works. There's no sense in which they've reacted in an attempt to shut it down or anything like that.
Yeah, no, not at all. I mean, I can't imagine that they would have. I mean, that would be such a bad look. But you never know, right?
And Annabelle, is there much in the way of directly political work in the show in that sense? Is there much that relates to specific issues, or is it much more sort of general points that are made?
No, there are quite a few direct points. I mean, the piece by Demian Dineyazi that you just mentioned, I did not notice the message at the press preview. I did go back during the members preview, and to be honest, once I knew the message was there, it was impossible for me not to see. And I felt like this was an important parallel to just the importance of knowledge in general. And I felt that it kind of, for me, was an interesting way to reframe the show as I went through again, because I felt that it really showed me that these lived experiences, these histories, these truths, you know, the real, as the exhibition title says, are erased, silenced, ignored. And once we kind of unearth them, we can challenge our own perspective and understand each other better. And so that was more subtle, but the more direct ones, certainly Kai and William's outdoor installation, which was on the sixth floor terrace. Their work is entitled Ruins of Empire II, or The Earth Swallows the Master's House, from 2024. And it's a replica of the north facade of the White House made in steel and dirt. And you can see it from the street, actually, as you're walking up to the museum. And it's this tilted structure that's kind of crumbling. And, you know, there's a clear metaphor for the U.S. political system. And then there's also Carmen Winant's massive prints. They're photographic prints. There's 2,500 of them that feature images of daily tasks of abortion, healthcare. So that's one that takes it on as well.
And then, Ben, the idea of bodily autonomy was again another theme that was mentioned in the blurb ahead of the show. Does that appear elsewhere, or is Carmen Winant's work the sort of most clear manifestation of an engagement with that territory?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a few other pieces that address it. It's definitely the most overt in Carmen Winant's piece, which is pretty spectacular. On the third floor, one of the only parts of the show that's not on the fifth or sixth floor of the Whitney is a series of, I guess there are Xeroxes of drawings by Pippa Garner, who's an artist who sort of made work about remaking bodies, remaking cars, remaking gender, deconstructing gender. So it's certainly more subtle than the Carmen Winant piece, but not that much subtler. And then there's also a piece quite near the Carmen Winant installation. There's a series of paintings by Harmony Hammond, one of which features like essentially swabs of blood in an abstract composition. And that piece is also very directly addressing women's bodily autonomy. Like I said earlier, there's one room that's kind of oddly all work about aging, which is really interesting. So I quite appreciated that sort of kind of body politics theme. Once you start to kind of piece out the different constellations of themes, I think you can really draw some interesting connections across the show.
And Annabelle, of course, there's this additional element of the show, or two actually additional elements, a film program and a performance program. When you go to the Whitney and see this exhibition, are you sort of conscious of that as a very present element, or does it feel like a separate entity in terms of the show?
You know, I feel like it's a bit of a separate entity. I think that the film that's incorporated in the main show is done well, but I don't know that it's clear to the average museum goer that these other elements exist. Certainly if you go, you will 100% see the films. They are integrated very well, built out very well, but I can't say that the other programs are made that clear.
Ben, did you find the same?
Yes, I would agree. I think there is already so much video work in the exhibition proper that I don't know that most visitors are going to say, oh gosh, I really need to watch more video art. I'm going to come back for a film program. To be honest, though, I think this is a problem that every Whitney Biennial encounters. In each one, there seem to be at least 5 or 6 hours of video in the galleries, and then they always curate a film program on top of that, and it seems like a mixed blessing to be one of the artists selected for the film program, because you're in the Whitney Biennial, but you're not in the gallery.
Yeah, I was wondering about that, because talking about the length of things, I mean, there's a magnificent work which was in London not too long ago by Isaac Junion, which is called Once Again, Statues Never Die, and it's an extraordinary piece about the Barnes collection and Adrian Locke and the Harlem Renaissance and so on.
Yeah.
But that in itself is almost feature length in my memory. I'd imagine it's about an hour long. So as you say, once you include those in the main show, it's going to be incredibly difficult to sample the exhibition as a singular entity. But I guess what I want to ask, Annabelle, is to what extent does the Whitney want that to be the case? Does the idea of a film program and a performance program suggest that the Whitney want the biennial to be something more of a festival than an exhibition as such?
Maybe, perhaps that's what they want. I don't know that that comes across. I definitely think that they could do that. But I do feel that if you are the average viewer, there are some films in the exhibition that, you know, like you said, they're long, but some I do feel like you could pop in and see a little bit. Sharon Hayes, for example, it's a series of interviews from the last decade that focus on sexuality and gender in the US. And she interviews groups kind of like in a round table. And I do feel that visitors could kind of pop into that and at least get some sense of the film. But, you know, others, like you said, the Isaac Julian one, I mean, I sat there for forever. So.
And one thing I always think about biennials is, do they leave space for delight? Did you have moments of like pure aesthetic joy? Is there space for that in this biennial?
I think there is. Yeah, I think so. You know, actually, the piece that Annabelle just mentioned, the Sharon Hayes video, I found really just delightful and very heartwarming and engaging. And I sat there for like at least 10 minutes during the preview watching it. I think there's a lot of work that is just sort of, from an aesthetic point of view, really rewards close and sustained looking. I mean, the Isaac Julian video that you just mentioned, there's an installation of sculptures by Rose B. Simpson, these kind of four totemic ceramic figures kind of looking at each other. That's really quite stunning. There's a Clarissa Tossin video and installation, which I really, really enjoyed. She basically 3D scanned ancient Mayan instruments and then made replicas of them and then recorded herself and other performers playing them, like sort of like using them as wind instruments, which you can't do with historic objects. And that piece is really beautifully installed and very engaging, and the objects are there on view. And I mean, the Keon Williams piece that Annabelle mentioned is pretty strident, but also, you know, materially very rich, and you can kind of get lost in it. And the other element of it is a stainless steel, I believe, statue of Martha P. Johnson standing off to the side of it, kind of protesting the White House. And there's a lot of play and fun to be had in that interaction. So yeah, I think there is some work that you can really kind of get lost in. On the other terrace of the show, there's a very, very large Turquoise Dyson sculpture and installation, which you're actually encouraged to sort of walk on and touch and interact with. You can literally get lost in it. I mean, it's kind of got all these nooks and passageways, and it's just kind of very delightful to walk around.
There was a mention there of Martha P. Johnson, and there's another work, of course, by Tourmaline in the show which references Martha P. Johnson.
Yeah.
That too is something that which the Whitney was at pains to point out ahead of the show, is that it will address the transphobia that is widespread in the US right now and elsewhere in the world. It was also notable that in the list of artists that were sent out ahead of the show, pronouns of all the artists accompanied their names. Is there a focus on gender identity in the show, Annabelle?
I mean, I think that the works that you pointed out, yes, but I don't think that that was like the strongest through line throughout the show. I mean, I do think it does lend to the overall theme of real and different lived experiences. So I think that that it certainly is there, and I'm happy that it was there, and I'm happy that it was done in a very graceful and successful way. I did notice that there were no pronouns on the wall labels, though, which was interesting to really have them on the information leading up, but not, you know, when you're there.
Right. And Ben, in a sense, that extends into a sort of second part of this last question, which is, to what extent is this a sort of inclusive biennial in terms of wanting to reach a broad audience? And to what extent is it about a broad natural audience for the Whitney's program anyway? In other words, there have been some critics who've said it's a show which is a mirror rather than a window, as in it's appealing to a silo of art goers, a community who would naturally come to the Whitney anyway. Do you have a sense of whether this is a show which can appeal to a broader audience? Can it extend beyond the Whitney and reach into parts that the Whitney wouldn't in terms of other shows?
That's something that I was sort of asking myself afterwards, after the preview, when I was contemplating my own expectations of the biennial and whether it was strident enough or not, or too restrained or not restrained enough. And yeah, it was this question of who's the biennial even for, right? I mean, is it for the New York and broader art community and just for us to check up on who curators think are the most interesting artists, or is it to bring the most interesting contemporary American art and beyond? There's a few artists who are not based in or from America at all in the show, which is a whole other question. Is it to bring those artists to a kind of wider audience? And I think there is work, like the Tourmaline video is an example, that really does kind of break out of the language of contemporary art and that you could come into very easily just from a sort of like visual pleasure kind of way. I mean, it's installed beautifully. It's probably the first piece that most people see. It has this like giant portal in the shape of a flower, and it's very visually stunning. So the Keon Williams piece is also quite polemical and grabby. So yeah, I think there is work that a general audience can get into the show through.
Well, Annabelle and Ben, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Whitney Biennial, even better than the real thing, is at the Whitney Museum of American Art in New York until the 11th of August. Coming up, visitor figures at museums and a drawing by Peter Bruegel the Elder. That's after this week's news bulletin. On the eve of the Art Basel Hong Kong Art Fair, which opens next week, a new security law amending Hong Kong's basic law, or its mini-constitution, was passed on Wednesday and will be implemented from Saturday. The Article 23 measure, which passed unanimously in the Hong Kong legislature, is a local follow-up to the national security law imposed by mainland China in June 2020. Backers and opponents alike say that the new article reinforces extended policies that have clamped down on resistance against Hong Kong's Beijing-controlled government, and that its impact will depend on actual implementation. A Hong Kong-based curator, speaking to the art newspaper anonymously, said that some contemporary art, like abstract art, will not be affected, but added that, quote, the space for the broader relevance of art is tightening and closing down. A spokesperson for Art Basel Hong Kong said that the fair has had no indication that Article 23 will impact their operations, had never faced any censorship issues, and had not been asked to do anything differently since the introduction of the 2020 National Security Law. Three paintings by Peter Paul Rubens will stay in Britain after the UK Spoliation Advisory Panel ruled that the trio of works should remain with their current owner, the Courtauld, in London. The works were once owned by the German banker Franz Wilhelm Koenigs, who transferred most of his collection to Lisse and Rosenkrantz Bank in Hamburg to secure a loan in 1931. When the bank went into voluntary liquidation in 1940, it sold the paintings to Count Antoine Celern, who later bequeathed them to the Courtauld Institute. The Spoliation Advisory Panel which rules on the ownership of disputed works of art, rejected claims from three separate parties for the Rubens pieces, including Koenigs's granddaughter, Christine Koenigs. She claims that Celan smuggled them without the necessary papers into England. But the panel concluded that the claimants had neither a legal nor a moral claim to the three paintings. The Denver Art Museum will repatriate 11 Southeast Asian antiquities from its collection. The works have been connected to the late British smuggler, Douglas Latchford, and his collaborator in Colorado, the late Emma C. Bunker, a longtime trustee and partner of the Denver Institution. The pieces will be returned to Vietnam, Thailand, and Cambodia, according to a museum statement. Bunker, an art historian who played a key role in Latchford's decades-long trafficking scheme, donated all of the aforementioned objects to the museum. Five are known to have passed through Latchford's hands. Bunker, who died in 2021, introduced Latchford, who died in 2020, to the museum and persuaded him to sell and donate a variety of historically significant statues from the Khmer Empire to the museum. She was never officially charged with a crime, but her name appeared in five civil and criminal cases related to Latchford's dealings. You can hear more about the trafficking of Cambodian antiquities in our episode from the 27th of May 2022 and read all these stories and much more on the website or the app. Now, our annual survey of museum visitor figures is published in full in our April print issue and online. As ever, it looks in depth at the number of people attending museums across the world. In the past few years, the numbers have, of course, been hugely affected by the pandemic and the slow resumption of global tourism. Visitor numbers have been rising gradually since 2020, but we're still far behind those in 2019. So what do the figures from 2023 tell us? I spoke to Lee Cheshire, one of the co-authors of the latest report. Lee, since the pandemic, we've had 2019 as this sort of benchmark year. Where are we at with that?
Well, yeah, for the last few years, we've been checking every year to see whether museums have got back to the kind of levels that they had in 2019 before the pandemic started. And it's been going slowly up. So in 2019, there were 230 million visitors to the top 100 museums in our survey. Then that fell to just 54 million in 2020. So it's been going up slowly, slowly. And then this year it's back up to 175 million. So not quite to the same level that it was, but we found that a lot of the big museums have got back close to or sometimes ahead of where they were in 2019.
Yeah, the big museums are in a way the most instructive parameter to assess the health of museum visits in a way, because they are such landmark institutions in their cities, in their countries and so on. And actually, they tell us quite a lot about the individual country's health in terms of tourism and so on. Let's look at the successes. So Uffizi, for instance, it's had its best ever year, and that's in Florence, of course.
Yeah, apparently it's gone up to 2.7 million visits in 2023, which is 15% more than in 2019. And the Accademia in Florence as well has gone up. They always had a record year of 2 million visits.
Right. And then in the US, the Met has done really well. So the Met's 10% up.
Yeah, although they did actually revise their 2019 figures down because of a change in counting methodology. But they're still 67% up from 2022. So that's a great year-on-year rise.
And generally, lots of what we think of as the big museums and galleries, so the Prado, the National Gallery of Art in Washington, the Vatican Museums and the Rijksmuseum, for instance, they're all in the sort of around 0% to sort of minus 5 or 10. So they're doing basically what they were doing in 2019.
Yeah, for many of them, 2019 was a record year. So we've said that anything within 10% of the 2019 figures, we would say is kind of back to normal. So yeah, lots of those are getting close to or in some cases exceeding those figures.
And the Vatican Museums is particularly striking because it had a record year in 2019. It was basically up to that level.
Yeah, so 2023 would have been its second best year on record.
Right. Now, let's talk about problematic institutions. The National Gallery in London, I think, is the sort of most landmark figure that we're looking at, because not only is it significantly down on 2019, but it's not that much up on 2022, for instance. And often you're seeing in the figures versus last year, like quite steep climbs upwards. But the National Gallery's not doing that great, even compared to that.
No, well, they've gone up 14% from 2022, and they were already kind of struggling a little bit in 2022 compared to their peers. So we found that they had the biggest fall of absolute visitor numbers of any museum in our survey. So in 2019, they had about 6 million visitors. And this year, well, in 2023, they had 3.1 million. So it's still pretty good. It still puts them just outside our top 10. But obviously that's a drop of 2.9 million visitors. So that's a lot of people to not be visiting your museum that were before. You know, on the other side, the Sainsbury Wing has been closed for the whole of 2023. So they've had reduced gallery space. A lot of the collection's not been on show. You know, one less entrance to go in. It's a bit more complicated the way you get into the gallery now. So that's probably going some way to explain why their figure hasn't gone up as much as their peers. But yeah, they're still 48% down on their 2019 figure, worse than most of the other museums in our survey. And also looking at ALVA's figures there, the Association of Leading Visitor Attractions in the UK, the National Gallery had the biggest fall of any of their institutions in their top 100. So it's a lot of people missing.
They're sort of being quite relaxed about it, or sounding quite relaxed about it, in the sense, as you say, they're pointing to the fact that part of the building is closed and so on, and that's reduced their programming. But they're not saying part of the building is closed and we're at capacity, are they? So they are lacking visits. It's not like they're turning people away. They are genuinely down in a broader sense.
Yeah, well, it would be interesting to see what happens in 2025 when the Sainsbury Ring reopens. We found this year the National Portrait Gallery, just around the corner, reopened after a long closure, so we didn't compare them to 2019 figures because they've been shut for the last few years, and reopened with a rehang and a renovation. And they've been receiving record visits. I think their reopening month was a record month for them. And they're on course now to maybe even double their pre-COVID visitor numbers. So maybe the National Gallery will follow the same trajectory.
That is a particularly notable example, because the National Portrait Gallery is effectively the same building. It's right at the back of the National Gallery. But I wonder if one of the key issues here is about access. And one of the things about the National Portrait Gallery's reopening is that they've got this grand new entrance. It's super welcoming. There are people outside imploring people to come in and being all friendly the minute you walk in. Whereas the National Gallery, as you say, they've got one entrance closed. But I do think there's a problem in terms of access, in terms of people walking up to the gallery and thinking, how the hell do I get into this building? And I do think that's something that new bit that they're opening in 2025 really has to address, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, this is something that we looked at last year. We saw that the National Gallery's website sort of implied that you have to buy a ticket, or, you know, you at least reserve a ticket online. You don't. You can just walk up to the museum and walk in. But the website feels like it was dissuading people. When you get there, there's a long queue. There's obviously more security arrangements than there were before because of the various things that have happened in the last few years. So compared to the National Portrait Gallery, they've got that brand new exit facing towards Leicester Square. It just feels wide open and you can just walk in. And even though, of course, they have the same security arrangements and issues that the National Gallery does. So that seems like it is kind of weighing on those figures. In terms of UK museums are unique because they're nearly all free entry, which is unusual compared to most of the museums in our survey. And I wonder whether the benefit that they have from that free entry in terms of extra visits is slightly being eroded by the increased difficulty of getting into the galleries, of having to reserve tickets online, of people perhaps not coming into the city. I've just been reading Laura Cumming's book, The Observer Critic.
Thunderclap,
yeah. And she talks about when she used to work in Soho and she used to go and walk into the back entrance of the National Gallery and go and see one of her favourite paintings on the way home from work. And you can't really do that anymore because it will take you 20 minutes to get through the queue to get in, and it's not so easy. So I wonder if some of the air's been knocked out of the UK and the London visitor numbers because of that.
That's interesting. That's true about the National Gallery, and I think more generally. But at the same time, curiously, we've been talking a lot on this podcast about crises at the British Museum, multiple crises. And yet here it is, having this really quite good year. I mean, one of the absolute lowest drops from 2019 of all the British museums.
Yeah, just 7% down on 2019. And the ALVA figures, they were the most visited attraction in the UK in 2023. So yes, they seem to be doing well. It's interestingly, the international tourism figures for England, as far as I understand, were 7% down on 2019, which was a record year. So they've recovered strongly as well. And it's interesting that the British Museum is also 7% down. So obviously a lot of their visitors are from international tourism.
And also key to point out is that the British Museum entrance is not a simple process. You do have to go through something like an airport type check-in and security check. Yeah. So it's not that puts people off entirely. entirely, is it? So that's a good example of a museum where there is quite stringent security, but you still can get numbers in, you know, close to 6 million people visiting.
Yeah, I guess those visitors are kind of more motivated if you're coming to London to go and see the British Museum, or if you're going to Paris to go and see the Mona Lisa, you're going to go and stand in a queue and book online and, you know, even pay for a ticket. Whereas the visits of people going to the National Gallery, perhaps, and places like Tate, where there were perhaps more kind of casual visits or kind of local visits, then perhaps that's why you were seeing a bigger drop there.
Yeah, and you're seeing disparity in the Tate figures, aren't we? So Tate Modern is getting close to where it was. It had nearly 5 million visits last year, and Tate Britain's nearly 40% down on 2019. So a bit of unevenness there.
Yeah, although the Tate have pointed out that 2019 was a record year for Tate Britain, and they were having a rehang in 2023. So some of the galleries were closed as well. So we should point that out. But yeah, 40% down is still quite high compared to some of their peers.
Central Europe's an interesting one because that seems to be much more back to normal than London, for instance.
Yeah, and we found that last year in a lot of the Paris museums were kind of already back to normal in 2022. So yeah, as we said, the Louvre just 8% down, but that's still with 8.9 million visitors. So they're not short of people visiting there. Musée d'Orsay was 6% up on 2019, so they had more visitors. So a lot of the European cities, particularly the kind of more tourist-oriented ones like Paris and Rome and Florence, seem to be doing really well.
And one of the institutions we focused on a lot on this podcast is the Humboldt Forum, which is obviously a deeply controversial project in Berlin, but that now does seem to be very much established as one of the leading museums.
They were the most visited museum in Germany that we found in our survey. They're one of a set of museums that opened, you know, during the lockdown or maybe a few years before the lockdown that sort of had record years in 2023, including the Louvre Abu Dhabi, the National Museum in Oslo, and then plus.
Now let's look at the US, because the US is, like the UK, quite uneven, isn't it? What did you detect in the trends for the US?
Yeah, again, it's hard to really pick out a trend, really. Some are doing well, like you say, the Met was kind of 67% up at 5.3 million visits, so they're doing well. Some of the smaller museums, like the Crystal Bridges Museum in Bentonville, they had a record year.
That's a free museum, isn't it? So that's a rare model for the US, but it seems to be working.
Yeah, definitely. But then some of the other big New York museums are, you know, not doing so well. So the Guggenheim's kind of being quite slow to get back to its 2019 figures. The Whitney, I mean, both of those are getting less than a million visits. So quite surprisingly low considering, you know, kind of how big and famous and, you know, how amazing those museums are.
That's one of the things that you do notice across the survey. We were talking about the Uffizi having its record figures for the year, but it's still below the National Gallery in London. So yeah, these things are relative in their different places. Staying with the US, Los Angeles is really consolidating its place in the kind of museum firmament. It's always been a major museum centre, but the numbers are looking impressive there.
Yeah, no, they've been solid this year. The Getty doing well, LACMA, Huntington, all doing well. And of course, LACMA's part way for a quite a major redevelopment. So when that opens next year, it keeps changing the times, but I think it's due for next year now. So that should see a big boom in visits there.
As you say, in the US, there are these sort of landmark museums whose reputation actually has always sort of been about, I guess, the kind of radical nature of their programming, more so than just the fact that they attract loads of visits. But something like the Broad, which has come along in Los Angeles, is an example of effectively a private museum, which is getting major museum numbers, right?
Yeah, I think it has a kind of popular program there. It reminds me a little bit of the Saatchi Gallery, perhaps. You know, so you've got lots of kind of very well-known artists. I think they've had a successful Keith Haring exhibition this year. So they're putting on things that people want to go and see.
Right. And one of the stories that we've covered a lot over recent years is China. 2023 was a major year in terms of COVID restrictions. So do the figures bear out the kind of intensity of those lockdowns in China?
Well, we don't have the figures yet for the big mainland Chinese museums, but the figures that we have for Hong Kong museums like M Plus are really strong. So M Plus opened in 2021 during kind of the lockdown. So it's never really had a good run yet in a full year. So 2023 was its first full year without being interrupted by lockdowns, and it had nearly 2.8 million visits. So that's enough to put it in the top 20 of art museums worldwide, you know, above the Rijksmuseum and the Uffizi and the Tretyakov in Moscow. So yeah, it's kind of established its place really on the top table.
Lee, as ever, thank you very much.
Cool, thanks, Ben.
The Visitor Figures Report is in our bumper April issue alongside our Venice Biennale magazine, an Expo Chicago supplement, and the Art of Luxury magazine. So do subscribe. And finally, it's time for the work of the week. This Saturday, the 23rd of March, the Ashmolean Museum in Oxford in the UK opens the exhibition Bruegel to Rubens, Great Flemish Drawings, which includes 120 works on paper by Flemish artists of the Renaissance and Baroque periods. Among them is Peter Bruegel the Elder's drawing, The Temptation of St. Anthony, from around 1556. And I spoke to Anne van Kamp, the curator of the show, about this work. Anne, Peter Bruegel created this drawing in 1556. How old was he then, and what level of fame had he achieved by that point?
So at the time when Peter Bruegel the Elder was making this drawing, he was sort of in his early 30s, so pretty early in his career. We know he was born around 1525, probably in an area near Breda in the northern Netherlands. We know he registered in the Antwerp Guild for Painters around 1551. Then as most Netherlandish artists at the time, he spent a few training years in Italy to really soak up the old masters, to get inspired by all the Roman ruins. And of course, with Bruegel, very famously, it's been said that when he travelled across the Alps, that he swallowed them. And then when he was back in Flanders, in the southern Netherlands, he spewed them back out in his wonderful landscape drawings. So with this drawing, with The Temptation of St. Anthony, we're pretty close to soon after he returns from Italy.
Right.
He returns from Italy around 1555, so roughly a year after his return to Antwerp.
And it's really crucial to establish that Antwerp at that time was an incredibly bustling centre for print and commerce. It was an important trading place. Antwerp was a very buzzing city at that moment, wasn't it?
Absolutely. It was one of the richest cities across Europe, and mainly because of its strategic position. It's sort of pretty centrally located in Europe, but also near the River Scheldt. And the river is really the key to Antwerp's success because it connects to all the inland rivers. For instance, the River Rhine is very accessible. So then you access the whole Holy Roman Empire from there. You can go to France, to Switzerland, but also the River Scheldt is connected to the North Sea. And then, of course, you can go south to the Mediterranean, you can go north to the Baltic Sea. And the River Scheldt just has that correct depth to allow international ships and local ships. So it's almost providence that Antwerp is located on this river.
And the print business in Antwerp is so crucial to the image that we're going to talk about, isn't it? Because it was made specifically for a print, for an engraving.
Exactly. The drawing is a print study, and Antwerp was indeed a huge centre for print making, for print publishing, for book publishing, book binding. Anything related to the distribution of words and images took place in Antwerp at the time. And the reason for that is that Antwerp housed some great publishing houses, and the publishing house that Peter Bruegel worked for, as, you know, sort of new on the scene again back in Antwerp after his journey in Italy, is the publishing house of Hieronymus Kock. And Hieronymus Kock really sort of catered towards that high-end print production, like the real connoisseurs who wanted to have wonderful prints to show off to their friends in their collection. And so this drawing is indeed a study for one of Bruegel's earliest print collaborations, because Bruegel was not a printmaker himself. To be an engraver at the time is a very specialist, very complicated, very highly skilled job, and so was usually left to do by professional printmakers who trained for years, ruined their eyes staring at this shiny metallic copper plate trying to scratch lines into the surface. And so usually what the print publishers did in Antwerp is they hired an artist, a designer, to come up with a really great design, and then that design was then passed on to the professional engraver to be translated into the copper plate.
What's really amazing about this drawing is that it exposes Bruegel's naivety or inexperience of printmaking at the time, doesn't it? Because when you see, and one will see in your exhibition, the print next to the drawing, you'll see that they have the same orientation, which means that Bruegel's trying to get his head around how to make a drawing for the engraving process. Is that right?
Absolutely. Yeah, you hit the nail on the head, because normally when you make a print design, you have to make it in reverse, because then the printmaker can copy your design exactly onto the copper plate. But once it's printed, imagine them running a sheet of paper on the copper plate, peeling it off, and then it appears in reverse. So a print designer, an artist who makes a print study, always has to make his design in reverse. And yet, yeah, as you say, Bruegel is not used yet to working with printmakers. It might be sort of his first fully fledged print design. And so maybe he's still trying to work out how to collaborate with these printmakers. So what we can assume is that Bruegel made this wonderful, fantastic drawing in the same direction as the print, to sort of maybe show to Hieronymus Cock and say, do you like this design? Is this what you had in mind when you employed me? Is this something that your printmaker can work with? And then maybe once Cock said, yes, this is great, maybe he then made the drawing in reverse, which was then used by the printmaker.
Right. And is an extraordinary drawing. And it makes me wonder about what the engraver thought when they were presented with this drawing, because it's so teeming with imagery, as one would expect from Bruegel, and gives the printmaker all sorts of challenges in terms of how to render this extraordinary depth of field and the amazing detail and these incredible, of course, fantastical creatures. Tell us about the composition.
Yeah, I do wonder what the printmaker thought when he got this drawing. Was he horrified? Was he amused? Was he engrossed in all the imagery? Because what we see indeed is it's a coastal scene or a riverscape. And in the middle of the drawing is sort of dominated by this massive floating head. The head is quite grotesque. One of its eyes got the shape of a paint window, which is broken with the burning basket sticking out of it. The nose of the head is pierced with a pince-nez. If you look further down, his gaping mouth is like smoke billowing out of the mouth. And then to top it all off, there's a giant fish lying on top of this head. And there's lots of things happening within the fish as well, with sort of grotesque creatures. And I think that the people at the time, even for us looking at this drawing, is pretty bizarre. But for the people at the time, it must have been even weirder. But what it did, I think, immediately conveyed was a sense of the imagery of Hieronymus Bosch, who was, of course, the famous artist who lived three generations before Bruegel. They never met, but it's clear that Bruegel was heavily inspired by Hieronymus Bosch when he was making this drawing. And I think the simple reason for that is that commercially, they were very popular images. Whether they were sort of used in a more religious way to instill fear and faith, or whether they were more satirical or amusing or a conversation piece. But these Boschian images were very, very popular at the time. And Hieronymus Cock, as a publisher, knew this. So he knew, if we keep publishing more of these Bosch images, these crazy creatures, these demons, these fantastical half human, half beast, half jug, half whatever creatures, then we might have sort of a bestseller on hand and we might actually sell this print. So what is interesting, although of course now everyone knows Peter Bruegel, in 1556 almost no one knew Peter Bruegel, so his name doesn't even appear on the print because he wasn't commercially viable, which is a really, really interesting sort of historical context for this drawing.
Absolutely. Are you suggesting that it's possible that Hieronymus Cock thought, well, if there is no signature, people might be convinced that it's a Bosch and therefore it will sell in greater volume?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that was his little trick that he had up his sleeve.
The interesting thing is that, of course, when you describe the images in the picture, of course, it's dominated by this head and this fish, but it's called The Temptation of St. Anthony. And St. Anthony is there, but you'd never know he was the main focus of the actual picture. But tell us about how he appears in the work.
Yeah, so you really have to look really, really closely at the image to find the poor, poor hermit St. Anthony kneeling and praying in the lower right corner of the print. So you really have to sort of drag your eyes away from that grotesque head and everything else that surrounds it to sort of land in a very peaceful corner of the print. And what's happening, it's the great St. Anthony. He's sort of the father of monasticism. He was the hermit monk to sort sort of isolate himself into the desert in Egypt, to really focus on his faith, to get away from all the distractions of the church or other people trying to distract him from faith. And so he is sort of the ascetic figure of Catholic history. And so we see him really trying to pray, concentrate, and everyone else around him is trying to distract him from his faith. But he looks very strong to me. I think he will persist and he will be able to keep his faith.
Exactly. And I think one of the things that really stresses is Bruegel's brilliance, in terms of he's often characterized as a kind of crude painter, a painter of peasant excesses and so on. Mm. But he's also a master of delicacy. And the depiction of St. Anthony is so exquisite, actually. And for instance, the way in a drawing, the way that Bruegel is able to establish the halo around his head. His holiness is so clear, is so manifest in the drawing. And then there's the delicacy of the drapery, for instance. So Bruegel's mastery is so multi-layered, it seems to me, and that's really evident in this drawing.
Absolutely. And he must have worked really closely with the printmaker, Peter van der Heijden, who did ultimately make the print after his drawing. Because as you say, to sort of make that halo pop in the image, you need to have clear instructions, like don't touch that area of the copperplate, keep it blank, make it shine, make it really stand out against all the images, all the lines, all the cross-hatching that you're applying to all the other areas. Yeah, it is a truly wonderful print, I think.
You talked earlier on about Bruegel's ability to absorb landscape in the context of the Alps. But one of the things, again, about this image, which is so instructive about what happens from here, is Bruegel's amazing ability to depict space. And I find it so moving every time I encounter his work, how marvellously, even despite everything else going on in the picture, he is able to capture the feeling, the atmosphere of landscape. And even in a drawing like this, he's able to do that, isn't he?
Yes, and I think the river onto which the head is floating is really that vehicle in this image, where it really draws you into the background. And once you get past the grotesque images and all the fantastical things that are happening in the foreground, once your eye sort of quiets down and you can focus on the background, you can just keep going. Like, you can keep staring at it, and there's tiny villages popping up in the horizon in the background. There's even a village on fire in the right background, which at first sight you might not notice. So you sort of get the turmoil on the right hand side of the image, and then you get the peaceful Brabantian landscape surrounding Antwerp in the background of the image.
Now, of course, it's a religious subject. There's an element of fantasy and so on about this work. But to what extent was it informed by the religious turmoil of the period? Because, of course, 1556 is right in the heart of the religious battles across Europe. The Counter-Reformation was gathering pace and so on. Antwerp is a Catholic city in the southern Netherlands, when Holland is now a Protestant space and so on. So tell us what's going on around Bruegel, if you like, and to what extent is he taking note of it?
Yeah, so Bruegel, definitely Catholic, and Antwerp, as you say, is sort of in the middle of it all, because its strategic position in Europe, because of the trade, because of the commerce, because of the intellectual centre of it being the print publishing capital of Europe at the time. And there's a real tug of war going on between the Catholics and the Protestants. And so the Spanish king, Philip II, was very interested in that region. And so there's constant battles about the regions. And so the Spanish did eventually conquer. And that's the reason why Belgium nowadays is still Catholic, and why Holland or the Northern Netherlands are still Protestant, because the Spanish could never conquer above Antwerp. But what is interesting about the drawing as well is because of the date, the 1556 date, which appears on it. And that year is quite significant as well, regardless of religious troubles, because it's a bit of a disaster year for the Southern Netherlands. There's a plague raging, but also for crops, for agriculture, it was a disaster year. So maybe the imagery, the doom, maybe was also related to that disaster year with the plague and with crops. And of course, let's not forget that St. Anthony is the patron saint of infectious diseases, of skin diseases. So that's where the link with the plague comes back in as well.
Right. So in a way, Bruegel here is perhaps illustrating the importance of faith in difficult times.
Absolutely, but in a really fun way, I'd say.
Well, Anne, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you.
Bruegel to Rubens' great Flemish drawings is at the Ashmolean Museum in Oxford in the UK from the 23rd of March to the 23rd of June. And that's it for this episode. You can find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Tan Audio, and on Facebook, Instagram, and Threads. The Week in Art is produced by Julia Mahowska, Alexander Morrison, and David Clack. And David's also the editor and sound designer. Thanks also to Daniela Hathaway and to our guests, Ben and Annabelle, Lee and Anne. Thank you for listening. See you next week. Bye for now.